Good afternoon. Good afternoon, and welcome to our first annual Rosenkranz discussion. Nicholas Quinn Rosenkranz, who's a constitutional law professor at Georgetown and a member of the Federal Study Board of Visitors, has been a trusted advisor of mine and a friend of the Federal Study for many years. Last year, we discussed the fact that this annual conference is a high-profile centerpiece on Thursday, our annual banquet, and a high-profile centerpiece on Friday, the Barbara Olson Memorial Lecture, but no equivalent centerpiece on Saturday. In talking about this, Nick and I concluded that the perfect Saturday centerpiece, most in keeping with the mission of the Federal Society, would be a sharp one-on-one discussion or debate between two highly prominent legal theorists. We're excited about this new annual component of the convention, and we're very pleased that the Rosenkranz Foundation has chosen to support it. For our inaugural Rosenkranz discussion, we are honored to have two of the most distinguished jurists in the country, Judge Richard Posner and Judge Mike McConnell. And we're delighted. And we're delighted that Nick Rosenkranz has agreed to moderate it. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Nick.
Thank you, Gene. It's a pleasure to be here to inaugurate this new component of the convention. As Gene explained, our idea was to increase the energy and the attendance of the Saturday of the convention. We can tell just from the attendance today that we've already succeeded in that. So we're delighted to have you all here. The hallmark of the Federal Society has always been the promotion of vigorous debate, and we thought the best possible centerpiece would be a sort of a one-on-one discussion between two of the greatest legal minds in the country. So we're thrilled today to have Judge Mike McConnell and Judge Posner for this inaugural discussion. Judge McConnell sits on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit. After 17 years teaching constitutional law and related subjects at the University of Chicago and later University of Utah, Mike McConnell became a circuit judge in December 2002. He continues to teach part-time as a presidential professor at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah, and as visiting professor at Harvard and Stanford Law Schools. Judge McConnell graduated from Michigan State University with a BA in 1976 and the University of Chicago Law School in 1979. Before entering teaching, he served as law clerk to Chief Judge J. Skelly Wright on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit and for Associate Justice William J. Brennan, Jr. on the U.S. Supreme Court. Also served as Assistant General Counsel of OMB and as Assistant to the Solicitor General of the United States. Before moving to Utah, he was on the faculty at the University of Chicago Law School, where he held the William B. Graham Chair. Before becoming a judge, Judge McConnell argued 11 cases in the Supreme Court, served as chair of the Constitutional Law Section of the Association of American Law Schools, co-chair of the Emergency Committee to Defend the First Amendment, member of the President's Intelligence Oversight Board, and special counsel to Mayor Brown, Rao and Maw. In 1996, he was elected a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Judge Posner sits on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. Following his graduation from Harvard Law School, Judge Posner clerked for Justice Brennan. From 1963 to 1965, he was assistant to Commissioner Philip Ellman of the Federal Trade Commission. For the next 2 years, he was assistant to the Solicitor General of the United States. Prior to going to Stanford Law School in 1968 as associate professor, Judge Posner served as general counsel of the President's Task Force on Communications Policy. He first came to Chicago Law School in 1969 and was Lee and Brenna Freeman Professor of Law prior to his appointment in 1981 as a judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. He was chief judge of that court from 1993 to 2000, also the founding editor of the Journal of Legal Studies with Orley Ashenfelter and the American Law and Economics Review. He was president of the American Law and Economics Association from 1995 to 96. He received his AB in 1959 from Yale and his LLB in 1962 from Harvard. He's also published, and no doubt these statistics are out of date already, some 45 books, 275 articles, 200 book reviews and short papers on a breathtaking array of subjects, and he is apparently the most cited legal scholar of all time. He's cited approximately as often as number two Ronald Dworkin and number three Oliver Wendell Holmes combined. It's a great honor to be here with the two of you today, and we thank you for inaugurating this new event. Our topic today is How Judges Think, which is also the title of a provocative new book by Judge Posner. Chief Justice Roberts famously remarked that judges are like baseball umpires. I think Judge Posner and Judge McConnell may differ about whether that's so, and perhaps they'll debate that point in a moment. But I'm sure we can all agree with the Chief Justice that nobody ever came to a ball game to see the umpire. Likewise, I'm sure none of you are here to see the moderator. So I will turn this over to Judge Posner for introductory remarks.
Thank you very much. So we agreed that each of us would give a little 7-minute introduction and then maybe a little rebuttal and then open it to questions. So if you were listening attentively, you realize why we were picked to debate. We're both former law clerks of Justice Brennan, a hero to the Federalist Society. But now all of us here, I'm sure, we worry about judicial discretion. We worry that judges, unlike other officials, really aren't under law. They're the makers of law. And we worry that maybe especially the highest judges aren't really engaged in an analytical process of discerning law and then applying it to new situations. When the remarkable statement by Chief Justice Roberts as he was about to be at his confirmation hearing that Supreme Court justices are like baseball umpires. So what was really remarkable was that no one on the Judiciary Committee called him on that, which tells us something about the confirmation process. Now, this is not an accurate description, obviously. Every serious person knows that American judges have a tremendous discretionary authority and have exercised it. And when you look at various bodies of law, not only the constitutional law, which is the obvious example, but statutory law, whether it's pension law or securities law or antitrust law, labor law, so on, they are largely creations of judges. And that, of course, is why confirmation hearings for federal judges are highly controversial, and why the controversy rises as you rise through the judicial hierarchy. So district judges are subject to quite a searching review by the courts of appeals, and of course many of the cases at the first level are routine, can be disposed of. The courts of appeals have a higher proportion of cases that are not easily disposed of, that are not routine, and of course the courts of appeals are subject to less scrutiny by the Supreme Court because of caseload constraints than the district courts are by the Court of Appeals. So as you move up in the hierarchy, a larger and larger percentage of cases are ones in which the judges exercise a largely discretionary, really a legislative power. We worry about this, and the question is there anything we can do? We're not going to eliminate judicial discretion in the American system. It's bound up with the vagueness of American law, which has to do with the lack of a party discipline, with the complexity of our legislatures, complexity of the society. And in the federal system, a combination of having a lateral entry judiciary, so you don't really have a judicial career, you come into the judiciary from another career. When you combine that with life tenure, it means you're not going to have the kind of discipline that you'd have in either a European-style judiciary or in a regular American business company, where people work their way up by satisfying their superiors. Here you have a lot of a lot of freewheeling principles in the judiciary. So there's just a tremendous amount of American judicial decisions that are really legislative in character. They're not applying some clearly understood body of existing law to a new situation. They are the judges making up the law as they go along. And if you look especially across Supreme Court jurisprudence, whether it's the Heller decision or whether it's Roe versus Wade, or I would say the entire capital punishment jurisprudence of the Supreme Court, much of free speech law, the flag burning cases, and much else, these are cases that could not be decided simply by the application of known law to facts. They are legislative decisions. Now, what could be done to narrow the area of discretion, if anything? And there are two candidates. And one is, I'm going to draw very, very briefly, obviously, but there's a recent book by a Columbia law professor named Philip Hamburger called Law and Judicial Duty. And it's a very ambitious and very interesting historical discussion of the role of the judge. And he explains that beginning the Middle Ages and refined through the 16th, 17th, 18th century is a concept of the judge that he thinks we've lost, but that he thinks is valid. And the essence of it has the judge seeing his role simply as applying existing law, whatever that existing law is, without asking whether it's good law or bad law, and without paying the slightest attention to the consequences of a decision one way or the other. And that is a form of judicial restraint that he commends. I don't think that actually can work in our system. But what some of our judges have tried to do, and some of the justices, is to discipline the judicial process by adopting a philosophy of decision making, whether it's originalism or active liberty or representation, reinforcement, a lot of candidates. And the reason that doesn't work is first that these philosophies turn out to be very loose, but also because the choice of the philosophy seems not to be dictated by anything except the preference of the particular philosopher. The validity of these philosophies are contestable and endlessly contested. So I don't think whether it's constitutional philosophy or the kind of historical study that Professor Hamburger has done, which is extremely interesting and well done, I don't think they work actually to discipline the judicial process. The alternative is something that's fallen a little out of sight, which is simply taking the position that judges should be just very, very reluctant to interfere with choices made by legislatures. It doesn't have any particular philosophical grounding. It has a pedigree of sorts. It's the constitutional philosophy of James Bradley Thayer in the late 19th century. It was picked up by Justice Holmes. And it just says, we're going to indulge a very strong presumption that state statutes and acts of Congress are constitutional. We're going to insist that their unconstitutionality be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. And there are good reasons for this, I think. In the case of the state statutes, I think it's very, very important to preserve the opportunity for experimentation with social policy by allowing the states to go their own way. And on that basis, I'm very, very pleased with the Supreme Court's decision of some years ago in the Zelman case, upholding school voucher systems against Establishment Clause challenge. Not that the Establishment Clause arguments, you know, Justice Breyer and others, not that they weren't perfectly respectable arguments, but we have a serious social problem in our public schools. Vouchers are one possible answer. If we snuff them out by a nationwide Supreme Court decision, we'll never learn how they work. On the federal level, there's also experimentation that we want to encourage. But in addition, for a statute actually to get enacted by the U.S. Congress, is really difficult. And we have essentially a tripartite legislature because of the president's veto, and we have these undisciplined parties. Actually, and the Senate operates on virtually a unanimity rule as a practical matter. Actually, you get a statute enacted means it's had a lot of deliberation, maybe a lousy statute, but it's had a lot of deliberation, a lot of consideration, has a lot of political force behind it. So let it flourish and see what happens. And reinforcing this, we have to be conscious of our limitations as judges. You know, Bob Bork had a great phrase for the Supreme Court many years ago. He said, well, when you get right down to it, the Supreme Court is just a committee of lawyers. And you really want a committee of lawyers running the country, making, you know, these very consequential decisions, such as whether we should have gun control, which is something that has bothered me. Now, when I talk in these sort of loose terms of, indulging a presumption of constitutionality, then people will say, well, that's not really law, you know, you're being a politician or something. But law is not the application of pre-existing rules, you know, using canonical methods. That's part of it. That deals with the routine cases. But there's much more to that. And so I'm going to quote Justice Scalia against Justice Scalia. So in Richardson versus March, he said, and I think this is terrific, I think absolutely rule. He's talking about the rules that juries are presumed to follow their instructions. And he said the rule is a pragmatic one, rooted less in the absolute certitude that the presumption is true than in the belief that it represents a reasonable, practical accommodation of the interest of the state and the defendant in the criminal justice process. He's talking pragmatism and reasonable, practical accommodation. And I think that's what law is at the higher levels, where you don't just apply existing law. And I want to just say one thing. Professor McConnell asked me a challenging question. How is this presumption of constitutionality ever rebutted? I still don't have a good answer, but I'm going to give an example of a case, just very, very briefly. I know I'm overstepping my 7 minutes. So in 1967, the Supreme Court in Loving versus Virginia held that laws forbidding interracial marriage violate the Equal Protection Clause. And I think that's a good decision. Now, the interesting thing about it is when the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868, anyone who had suggested that a law forbidding interracial marriage was unconstitutional would have been regarded as a nut. That was an era in which states like Maine had laws against interracial marriage. And in the early years of the 20th century, these laws burgeoned in the western states, where they decided, yeah, interracial marriage means white people can't marry Indians, can't marry Japanese, this, that, and the other. It was not really until like 1967 that a decision holding that these laws were unconstitutional could have been regarded as acceptable. And what I think happened was that in 1868, the Equal Protection Clause meant one thing, and in 1967, it meant something else, even though the words were the same. And what had changed is not anything that's sort of in the conventional vocabulary of legal analysis. What changed was a society changed around the law, and the law came to mean something completely different from what it had meant a century earlier. And I think is the ineradicable discretionary content of law. Yes, it's sometimes you'll say these interracial bans, these are deeply offensive, and so we're going to hold them unconstitutional. And that, I think, is about all that can be said, and all the rest in the opinion is going to be window dressing. So, stop there. Thank you.
Well, I have to begin with a note of humility here to thank the Rosencrantz Foundation and Federalist Society for putting me up here next to Judge Richard Posner, for whom I have such a great affection and regard. I was a law student when he arrived at the University of Chicago faculty, and he was a giant then, and now, even now, as I have the occasion to read opinions from courts all around the country, when there is a case written by Dick Posner on point, I tell you, I sit up and pay notice, and my experience is that there are really few jurists in the country with his very good judgment. I remember when I was clerking for Justice Brennan, I remember Justice Brennan commenting, I don't know if anyone has ever told you this, but I remember him commenting that he had only known two authentic geniuses in his life, and one of them was Dick Posner. He and I also co-authored a Law Review article some years ago, so we are not, please don't mistake this discussion here as anything other than a conversation among friends. I'm inclined, having gone to the Mark Stein lecture yesterday, to say that if Mark Stein is the Bridget Bardot of Canada, that Dick Posner is the learned hand of our generation. So I'm extremely proud to be up here. Judge Posner has recently written this extremely interesting book on how judges think, and I actually find it a rather disturbing book, and I'd like to explain why. Now it has a both, because it turns out that rather than asking what makes how judges think distinctive from other actors in the political process, that the answer to how judges think is, well, let me just give you, is pragmatism is the word, and let me give you the definition here on page 13. A pragmatic judge assesses the consequences of judicial decisions for their bearing on sound public policy as he conceives it. For their bearing on sound public policy as he conceives it. Now, that seems to me not to distinguish between what judges do, how judges think, the judicial role, and what legislators do, how legislators think, what is the legislative role, which is, after all, to assess the consequences of what they're doing with respect to sound public policy as they conceive it. And I think that this is not a good thing for our system of constitutional governance, to obliterate the distinction between the legislative role and the judicial role. Now, in his remarks that we've just heard, Judge Posner emphasizes a point on which I think he and I are completely in accord, which is that the judicial role ought to be deferential. That is, the judges really have no business stepping in and overturning legislative decisions lightly. And on that, I think we're in agreement. And maybe we ought to have a third person up here who's a little bit more of a robust, muscular advocate of judicial review, because, you know, on this, we're on the same page. But I don't believe that pragmatism is compatible with this more modest judicial role, whereas I think that I particularly believe that the legalist method, to use Judge Posner's term in the book, that his denigration of legalism is unfortunate, both in terms of the separation of powers in the Constitution, but also by virtue of this criterion of what is how much it would lead to judicial overreach. Legalism, as Judge Posner defines it in the book, is what I would call, and in fact he calls, following the law, although in his book he puts law in scare quotes. I would have said that was the essence of the judicial function, and that means looking at the traditional legal materials of text, history, past practice, and precedent, rather than looking at the consequences of the decision with an eye toward its bearing on sound public policy as the judge himself conceives it. Now, insofar as Judge Posner's book is a description of what judges actually do, and there's a lot of that in the book, I don't necessarily disagree with that. I think it is not exactly a state secret that the judiciary very commonly does overstep its bounds. Many judges do act like legislators. And so as a description of what is very common, I don't have any quarrel with that. But it seems to me that pragmatism is a prescription for more of the same rather than a critique of that. Let's begin first with the issue of legislation, because, I mean, judges obviously are deciding on the basis of a number of different bodies of law. Legislation is the most common, at least in the federal appellate courts. There's also common law. There's also various consensual arrangements like contracts, and then, of course, perhaps most important of all, constitutional law. But let me begin with legislation. Of course, Judge Posner is right that the statutes don't answer all questions, and therefore there is going to be a range of discretion left to the judge at the end of the day, where the judge has to figure out, well, what are we going to do? This a kind of interstitial interpretation where the statute is unclear and where the precedents leave range. It's what makes our job interesting. If every case were easily decided, I don't think people like Judge Posner and me would care to be judges. And I also admit that there is a serious temptation when faced with those open-ended questions. There's a temptation to read the statutes in order to produce the consequences that, as a matter of sound public policy, as I conceive it, would be right. But I view that as a temptation to be resisted rather than an invitation for proper judicial decision making. There are many statutes on the books that I would not have voted for. When I am a judge interpreting such a statute, I do not feel free, and I may do it as a descriptive matter, but as a normative matter, I do not feel free to sabotage Congress's work because in my judicial role. Instead, when I get to that end, when discretion is necessary, what I try to ask myself is what interpretation of the statute is going to carry forth the language and purpose of the statute as best I can understand it. Because I believe that the function of law, and therefore the function of the judge, is not one of a second-order legislature. I believe that the reason why Congress passes laws is they've been elected democratically, they are entitled to write the rules, and the agency of government in which Judge Posner and I both sit, our job is to carry that forward dispassionately and as apolitically as fallible human beings are able to do. Similarly with contracts, if there's an ambiguity in the contract, I'm not sitting there to try to figure out what the best contract would be for those people to have entered into, leading to the best consequences for policy as I conceive it. Rather, I do my best to figure out what the parties intended and to enforce the contract, unless, of course, there's public policy or legislation standing in the way. Common law is a little bit more difficult because in the common law system, judges have been delegated by the people with a certain degree of more of authority, which is a little bit more legislative in nature. And there, I think that attention to sound public policy consequences is a bit more appropriate, at least for the judiciary as a whole, although for us as federal judges, Our job is actually not to create the common law. Our job is to stand, because we hear common law cases in the diversity jurisdiction, our job is to look at the state common law, and if the state common law is not clear, to make the best, most dispassionate judgment that we can as to how the state courts would decide that question. And again, it's often tempting to go for the consequences that I think would be best, but that's a temptation to be resisted, not a not a recommendation for how judges ought to behave. Now, constitutional law I've left for the end, and that's probably the most potent. But here I would say that the same thing essentially is true. I ask, what's the purpose of Congress passing laws? I want to know what is the purpose of people writing a written constitution. And I think the purpose of that is to establish a set of powers and of limits on those powers. And the powers only go so far, and the limits are there. And I think that it's the job of the judges to carry that out as best they can. And at a certain point, and I'll talk about precedent in just a moment, unless I've gone on too far, too long, but because I do think precedent is an important part of the system. But putting that aside for just a moment, at a certain point, does the text run out? Does history run out? Does not provide an answer? Of course it does. Many cases that is going to be true. But at that point, I do not believe that it is the appropriate role of the judge to look to the consequences of the decision as to their bearings on sound public policy as he conceives it. At that point, it's the job of the judge to say it is not unconstitutional. That is, when the Constitution runs out, when the text doesn't provide an answer, when the history doesn't provide an answer, when the precedent leaves it open, it isn't open to the judges then to step in and make the decision instead of the representatives of the people. It is at that point the job of the judge to sit back and say that this is an appropriate decision for the democratic branches, because our Constitution is not made up just of limitations on government. It is also an empowerment of a democratic process. It is just as important in interpreting the Constitution to allow the elected branches of government, state as well as federal, to act within the areas in which they have been left free to act, as it is to tell them no when they infringe the limits on that doctrine. And I think that the idea that the role of the judge is to be the pragmatist, to try to sort of to try to make things come out right, is simply to step into the role which has been left in our Constitution to the political branches. Now, that's probably enough said for now. We might talk about precedent later.
Posner, would you like to take a few minutes?
Yeah, I'll just take a couple. So I think what Judge McConnell has said is sort of aspirational. It would be nice if we could decide all the cases using techniques of legal reasoning which clearly belong to judges and clearly distinguish our work from that of legislators. Unfortunately, I don't think that's possible. And also, I don't think it results in, with my loose pragmatism, I don't think it results in a tendency to interfere with government. That depends entirely on the temperament and attitudes of the judge. I happened to find on the web recently a list of the 161 statutes that federal statutes that the Supreme Court has held unconstitutional since Marbury versus Madison. You have to add Heller now. I looked over that list. I didn't see any, actually, statutes that I, with one exception, that I would have thought unconstitutional. You have the income tax, you have the child labor. It's quite a list that the Supreme Court knocked out. The only one which seemed to me a disturbing statute was school segregation in the District of Columbia, which the Supreme Court invalidated in Bowling versus Sharp, 1954, companion case to Brown versus Board of Education. Of course, there's a tremendous problem there, which is that there's no equal protection clause applicable to the federal government. So Bowling versus Sharp is sheer judicial arm twisting. On the other hand, the spectacle of having segregation in the District of Columbia when the Supreme Court had just invalidated the rest of the country was kind of impossible, right? So people would say, well, the Supreme Court justices, they're not going to desegregate the schools their children or grandchildren go to. They just do it for the rest of the country. So that's a decision which can't be justified, I don't think, in sort of legal reasoning terms, but nevertheless probably the right decision. But for the rest of it, I have no particular desire to knock down state or federal statutes. I don't do that. But as I say, it's not because I feel penned in by text and history and precedent and all that. It's that I'm not that political in my outlook. So I don't know what I'm sorry about that. Judge McConnell, I remember him, of course, as a professor. No, no.
Let's go back all the way.
No, I have to say, Judge McConnell, he was very polite when he said that Justice Brennan said I was one of the two geniuses he'd ever met. He didn't mention the other one, Justice Douglas. So that's always been, you know, it worries me. It's like Macbeth, you know, in Macbeth starts off, he's killed this traitor, the Thane of Quarter. And as a result, the king says, you know, you did this great job, you killed the traitor, I'm gonna make you the Thane of Quarter. And there's a sense in which, you know, Macbeth is uncomfortable because now he's being cloaked with the title of this guy who was a traitor. And of course, he's going to end up being a traitor. So if I'm being bracketed with Justice Douglas, you know, I'm getting really worried. Here's the problem with the attempt to use history and precedent to decide these very difficult cases. It seems to me if you take something like Bowling versus Sharp, or if you take Loving versus Virginia, if you look at history, if you look at original meanings, those cases are decided in a very questionable fashion. It would be very hard for the Supreme Court to say, I think, that yes, bans on interracial marriage are constitutional, because in 1868 they were considered entirely appropriate. I don't think that's possible. Then you could say, well, but there had been decisions in between them in 1967, decisions in other race cases. But the problem with reliance on precedent is that often the precedents are themselves, from a legal reasoning standpoint, illegitimate glosses on some original meaning. And so some Supreme Court justices, like Justice Thomas, are skeptical about reliance on precedent because, after all, those precedents may be arbitrary legislative acts. So there's something wrong when a judge says, well, I'm constrained because I just follow precedent, if the precedent was itself the unconstrained legislative decision of an earlier generation. I think it's a problem for Justice Scalia because I think his originalism is acceptable in part because since he does give weight to precedent, he doesn't have to carry through the whole logic of his position. For example, the incorporation of most of the Bill of Rights against the states by the Supreme Court, that is not originalism, that's judicial aggression. So I think precedent is a quicksand on which to rely. I think history is worse. That what particularly bothers me about the Heller decision, apart from the fact that I don't think the Supreme Court has any business involving itself with gun control policy across the nation. Now, of course, Heller hasn't yet been applied to the states. Maybe it never will be. I am not permitted to speculate on that. That's pending litigation. But in any event, I don't see this why the Supreme Court should be interested in getting involved with gun control. Emotional subject, you know, remote from any central concerns of the legal system. Obviously, a variant problem across the nation. Big cultural differences, big cities, rural, so on. Second Amendment, 18th century document. No conceivable conception of problems of modern weaponry, modern modern cities, modern crime problems, and so on. But here's what particularly bothers me, and that is Supreme Court justices setting themselves up, not just Justice Scalia, certainly Justice Stevens, as historians. Now, you can have brilliant law clerks and the entire resources of the Library of Congress. That will not change a judge into a historian. History is a profession. People devote their lives to it. You don't send out a bunch of law clerks for 2 or 3 months and turn them and yourself into a historian. I think it's illegitimate for judges to base their decisions on history. If the history is controverted, if it's something everyone agrees to, fine. But when you have professional historians weighing in, now the professional historians tend to decide with Justice Stevens. That doesn't mean they're right. A lot of history is simply indeterminate. But in any event, I don't think this is something judges can do. So what I see judges doing when they emphasize history, they emphasize precedent, is pretending, and I'm not saying they're hypocritical or anything like that, but they are trying to give the cloak of objectivity, the appearance of objectivity to a legislative act. And one more point, this is something on which Justice Scalia and I very much agree. I do not approve of courts citing foreign decisions as authority. Now, if they want to cite a foreign decision and say some court in Zimbabwe made a very interesting point about executing 12-year-olds, that's fine. That you can find knowledge, it can be found anywhere. But to count noses and say, well, every country in the world except the United States doesn't permit execution of minors or of retarded people or child rapists or what have you. That, I think, is illegitimate. Because actually, to understand the significance of decisions by Supreme Courts in the other 192 countries in the world, you would have to be enormously well-informed about the judicial systems, the political cultures, the legal cultures, the languages of the 192 countries. And in fact, our Supreme Court justices and our judges, and certainly including myself, we know very, very little about any of these subjects. So this is more window dressing, and I see judicial historiography, judicial precedent mining, and judicial foreign citations as example of the fig leafing, the window dressing that judges engage in because we are reluctant to acknowledge that there is this significant fraction of cases where we are making legislative judgments because we don't have the materials to make a judicial, disciplined judicial decision.
Well, there were a lot of points there. We're talking aspirations here. That is to say that, what are the norms for the legal profession, for the judicial portion of the legal profession? And this is what Judge Posner is an icon. And that's why, in part why the book concerns me, because when Judge Posner talks pragmatism and talks consequences, we know that he is then going to carry that through with appropriate modesty and deference and enormous learning and understanding. But he has now with all the force of prestige of his position, has announced that judges in general should decide cases not on the basis of legalism, which is a mirage, right, but instead on the basis of their assessment of consequences, right, and not all judges are going to be Dick Posners. There will, for example, be judges who believe their idea of the consequences and sound public policy is that it would be a good thing if the elites of other countries in the world, especially Europe, thought better of us, right? That's a consequence, right? And thus, that's why, and that, of course, is why there's a fad for citing foreign law, is because justices who enjoy collegial exchanges with the Germans and the Dutch and the Belgians and so forth don't like being told that they're barbarians. And that's a consequence, right? And so, and maybe to elevate that a little bit, it isn't just personal. They think that the United States suffers internationally and has, and that there's serious untoward consequences for our foreign policy and our leadership role in the world by virtue of the fact that the elites of Europe believe that we are barbarians, right? So these are the sorts of, once judges are liberated to disregard the legalist principles and instead to look simply at consequences by their own lights, they are free to do whatever they want. And I say that however fragile the limitations may be of text and history and precedent, that they are all that we stand between, all that stand between the rule of law and a free-for-all, with judges simply doing whatever they want. And again, my quarrel with Judge Posner is not his heartfelt and entirely sincere judicial restraint, which I admire and share. It's the it's his stripping the legal process of its legal underpinnings. The acid skepticism with which he approaches text and history and precedent that I think is that's very damaging. But I also think it's false. So now we need to talk about some of these elements, and particularly. Let me touch briefly on precedent and then talk a little bit more about history. Precedent does have to be part of the process. I know, you know, my friend Michael Stokes Paulson argues otherwise, and so do some other folks who sometimes inhabit these tables. But precedent, I think, is an essential part of the judicial process. Always has been in the English-speaking world. Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 78 refers to it as indispensable to proper judging. But I don't think that precedent trumps the other more fundamental portions of the law. This is roughly the way I think it works, that we have a text, you begin with the text, but if you look just, and the text itself answers some questions. Right, there's some things that are plainly constitutional, some things that are plainly unconstitutional, and you don't really need to do anything other than just look at the words. There are not a lot of important questions decided that way, but there are a few. Then the next step is you look at the history, and I think that the history does, in many instances, narrow the meaning of the text. We know pretty well that the Due Process Clause did not include a right to have an abortion on demand. I think that's a pretty clear matter. I think that there, so the history narrows, to some extent. But does it eliminate all ambiguity? Of course not, Right? That's the originalist step in the process. It does not answer all questions. So the idea that originalists just look back and they say, well, what did the Constitution mean as originally understood, gives you an answer to every case. That's just cartoonish. That's not what happens. The history narrows the range, but that still leaves some range. And then we've had 200 some odd years of experience since then with a number of these areas. And the people, through consistent enactment of laws and through executive actions and so forth, have given further, have further narrowed. And the judges, the judicial decisions, and their precedents also further narrow. I do not consider those narrowings, those two types of precedent, both democratic and judicial, I don't view those as laid in stone in quite the same way the text is laid in stone. They can be revisited, but unless there are powerful reasons to revisit them, they serve to channel judicial discretion, and they have a democratic legitimacy, especially the first kind of precedent, that of multiple and legislative acts, but also precedent insofar as precedents are repeated and accepted by the people and become embedded in the law, they have a kind of a democratic legitimacy. I do not believe that precedent in the form of one Supreme Court decision, you know, 5-4 that upsets everybody, I don't believe that that has much precedential value at all, right? But a precedent, say the precedent establishing the incorporation of the Bill of Rights, which I also think, by the way, is historically defensible, or a precedent like holding that gender discrimination is unconstitutional or at least deserving of something close to strict scrutiny under the Equal Protection Clause. Things of that sort are accepted. Most people agree with them, whether they were right or wrong. We have no business, we have no call to go back and relitigate those questions. So precedent and practice are then narrow, but even then there is going to be a range. Right, and this is, I think, the most important question. When you get to that range and there is still some open room in a constitutional case, that means it is constitutional. That means that the legislature gets to make the decision. It doesn't mean that we get to decide what we think would be best. So that's precedent. History, no, of course judges aren't historians. Of course, we aren't economists either. Economics is a profession, right? And we can't send our law clerks out to learn that and to run the regression equations and so forth. That doesn't mean that judges should disregard economic logic when it comes to cases that have an economic impact. That would be idiotic. I think, and of course, the way history comes into the decision of cases is very rarely, maybe almost never, through the original historical research of judges. It comes through the medium of the work of professional historians and the purveyance of that through briefs and of good lawyers. Then, of course, judges have to evaluate some of that, and sometimes it's going to be tough. And I freely concede that there are some very difficult, contentious historical questions. If it's on the razor, if it's on the 50-50, then that strikes me as a good reason to say, well, the legislature should be able to do what it wants, because there's no clear showing of unconstitutionality. The problem with condemning history as a mode of interpretation has to do with the cases that are not like this, right? Because once we say, as a matter of principle, that history is irrelevant to constitutional interpretation, that applies even when the history question is relatively easy. And that means that judges are free to interpret the Constitution in ways that they know, we all know, have no possible historical basis and the understanding of the clause as it was enacted by the people, right? And so to argue from the proposition that many historical questions that face us in cases like Heller, for example, are very difficult ones, to the proposition that therefore we should feel free to interpret the Constitution in accordance with our view of consequences in light of the sound public policy as we conceive it, and ignore and in the face of history, I think is a very is truly a prescription for an out of control judiciary.
Let me reply just to two points very briefly. First, any position that a judge wants to take on whatever grounds can be rationalized in a judicial opinion, which will look like a real work of legal reasoning. It'll deploy precedent and history and canons of construction, what have you. The repertoire, the rhetorical repertoire of the judge and the lawyer is of infinite size and elasticity. And so one danger is the judge who believes that using this repertoire can justify the most far-reaching revolutionary decisions. So you read the opinions about gay marriage in this Massachusetts and California and so on. They are very legalistic opinions. They are full of history and precedent and analogy and this and that. I think, as I say, that's fig leafing, and I'm bothered that Judge McConnell does not seem to be bothered by the phenomenon of fig leafing and window dressing by which judges disguise their policy judgments. Whereas the judges like Holmes, who are pragmatists, who are skeptics, who are not legalists, they become timid when it comes to interfering with the other branches because they don't feel, they're not comfortable with the kind of rhetoric that justifies, that is used to justify these wild decisions. And they are skeptical just about their own knowledge of what is good for the country. So I'm worried about the judges who really think they have an analytic methodology by which they can decide any case. The second related point, I'm really surprised by what Judge McConnell says about gender discrimination. It's almost as clear that the Equal Protection Clause was not about men and women as it is that it wasn't about banning interracial marriage. So what that means is, and I'm not saying I disapprove of the decision in the slightest, look at the Bill of Rights and you look at the 14th Amendment. You have just a lot of general stuff which the courts have molded to fit current values and current policy preferences. There's no fixity in the Bill of Rights. The important part of the Constitution is the Constitution of 1787. The Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment are fluff. There is no fixed meaning to terms like equal protection, due process, cruel and unusual punishment, right to counsel. Just go through all the things the Supreme Court has done in the name of the Constitution that has no basis, whether it's paying for indigent defendants' lawyers or requiring that the lawyer, you know, be effective, or the examples I've given and many other examples. I don't see how those decisions can be justified on any basis other than the justice is considered current needs, current pressures, consequences of alternative decisions. It's a fact that today, because of the complexity of criminal law, it would be very difficult for an unrepresented person to cope with a prosecution, which was not true in the 18th century. It would be difficult for a person to survive a criminal prosecution if his lawyer was not minimally competent. Those are facts about today. They're not facts about the 18th century. And you know, you can you can conceal the legislative element of constitutional interpretation and much statutory interpretation. Sherman Act 1890, you think modern antitrust law bears the slightest resemblance to what Senator Sherman and his colleagues thought in 1890? Of course not. So I think without the fig leaves, if we're candid about what we are doing in this open area where the orthodox materials of legal decision making don't close the deal, then we would be more cautious about constitutional and statutory innovations, not more freewheeling.
Well, obviously the doctrinal toolbox is large. I don't think it's infinite. I've had the experience, I'm sure you've had the experience, I suspect everyone in the room has had the experience, except maybe for young Mr. Leo here, who probably hasn't yet read any Supreme Court decisions, or other court decisions, of reading cases and saying, they just made that up, right? That's the technical term for the fig leaf being falling off, right?
Image. Yeah.
It's remarkable, though. I mean, I think that this experience shows that it is not possible to dress up every possible decision in plot. Yeah, they can have citations. Yes, they can invoke some history and so forth. But there are many decisions that I think, you know, left, right, and center, any person who cares about legal professionalism and craft would say that opinion just doesn't hang together. The authorities on which it cites are simply not there. And I think that for most of the pyramid of judicial decision making, that these materials are much more constraining than Judge Posner lets on. Yes, there are very important high-profile cases where it's harder to tell the difference. But through much of the legal system, these constraints are quite real. I teach a course, the Supreme Court simulation seminar, I call it, in which the students, nine of them form a court and two of them argue, and they read the briefs from current cases in the Supreme Court. And, you know, students tend to be quite ideological and they bring a lot of prior preferences to these cases. But every time I sit back and listen to the deliberation of the court, the nine students, as to how they're going to decide. By the way, they're free to, they can overrule precedent, they can do whatever the Supreme Court can do within the terms of the course. Every time I sit back and hear students say something like, well, I really want it to come out this way, but I just can't do it. The law won't go that way. It's a process of discovery for the students that law is, in fact, constraining. Not, of course, infinitely constraining, but it is certainly not infinitely malleable either. And then this brings us, I think, to the to an empirical proposition that Judge Posner lays before us. His empirical proposition is that judges who are taught and believe the norm of pragmatism, that they should make sure that the consequences are in accordance with sound public policy as they conceive it, will be more restrained, less likely to throw their weight around, than judges who are imbued with the norm of legalism, which is to say that they are bound by text and history, legislative intent, in the case of legislation and precedent. I'm not sure how we can test that proposition. Maybe we'll have maybe over the next 8 years we'll have an opportunity to have it tested even more than in the past. But I just have to say I don't believe it. That seems to me completely implausible.
Judge Posner, I wonder if you could speak to this question of institutional competence. So your brand of pragmatism seems to have a substantial dose of economics, that the judge should be weighing the consequences of his decision, and I think you mean social consequences, costs and benefits out in the world. And can you speak a bit about why you're confident that judges could do that in a way that you're not confident that they can do history, for example?
No, I don't. There are areas of law, for example, antitrust law, telecommunications law, certain types of environmental issues, where the statutes are using economic, or they're alluding to. Economic concepts, and where economics provides a framework for analysis that may be quite uncontroversial, and then the problem for the judges is with any other technical areas: how do you obtain technical knowledge? How do you understand the concepts? Well, it's the duty of the lawyers to explain the concepts in a way that the judges can understand. Then, when it comes to fact application, expert witnesses, and so on, we can deal with that. I happened to hear a telecommunications case a couple of months ago, coming out soon. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Telecommunications Act of 1996. It's incredibly complicated. As Mr. Rosenkranz mentioned, I used to know a lot about telecommunications, but the industry has changed completely. So we had this case. And I read the briefs, and my law clerks read the briefs, and we didn't have any idea what the case was about. And at the argument, I said to one of the lawyers, I read the briefs, my law clerks read the briefs, we do not understand what your case is about, and I want you to explain in words of one syllable what this case is about. And he was taken aback. But he did it. He explained in words of one syllable. We understood it. I wrote an opinion, coming out soon. And I'm comfortable with it because I forced him to explain the thing to me. And that's what we have to do in many areas, I think. We have to force the lawyers to explain the case to us. I would not take the economic approach and use it in, you know, to deal with Loving versus Virginia, anything like that, except in the sense that I think decision making is inherently a matter of costs and benefits, not any technical, but in the sense that you're looking at the pros and cons, the effects of the different decisions. So I think that's inescapable, unless you're lucky enough to have one of these cases where the history or the precedent really is really makes you comfortable with a decision that doesn't involve you to make a legislative type of judgment. I'd be interested in what Judge McConnell thinks about some of the cases I've mentioned, like Loving versus Virginia and Bowling versus Sharp and Roe versus Wade and the rest. I mean, some of these are you know, really tenuous, and like Roe versus Wade, but the others, I think they're good decisions. I think the gender discrimination interpretation of equal protection clause is a sensible decision. I don't see how they can be gotten with the standard techniques of legal reasoning.
So Loving versus Virginia. Judge Posner told us a bit earlier that no one could possibly have imagined that miscegenation would have been thought to be unconstitutional anywhere near the time of the 14th Amendment. He actually speaks too quickly there. A number of people imagine that. It was not as if this issue was not debated at the time. It is true that the Republicans, and now I'm talking about Big R Republicans, the party of civil rights, made a deliberate strategic or tactical, I'm not sure which it is, decision that miscegenation would not be the fight that they fought because it was an extremely unpopular application of the 14th Amendment. It was even unpopular among the large majority of their African-American constituents, to whom they were quite attentive at the time. So it was something that they wanted to avoid politically, and so here's how it came up, and I think this is really rather interesting. The Democrats who opposed various Reconstruction measures, and here I'm thinking particularly of the Civil Rights Act of 1875, charged that if you believe the principles of these bills, then the logical concomitant of that is that miscegenation laws must be unconstitutional, right? And that was a potent political charge. In fact, it was one of the most commonly common charges leading to some, you know, real, actually to some rather scurrilous moments in the debates. In which I remember on one occasion a congressman, I believe it was a congressman from Kentucky, had said why this would lead to this means social equality, by which he meant sexual intermingling of the races, to which one of the Republicans responded, "Why, sir, in the South you never had any kind of equality except social equality." And the Republican reaction to the charge that miscegenation was the logical concomitant of their position is interesting. It was silence. I am not aware, I think I've read every word of these debates, I am not aware of an instance in which one of the Republican supporters of the Reconstruction measures said, "No, anti-miscegenation laws are constitutional." Basically, they changed the subject. They made fun of the Democrats along the lines that I just mentioned. They dodged the question and so forth. I think that Loving versus Virginia was an authentic interpretation of the principles of the 14th Amendment. It was one that was too much of a political hot potato for the Party of Civil Rights at the time to be open to actually support. Right, but they did not deny it, and I think that it followed from the principles that they were willing to stand up for and support, and thus I think that it was correctly decided on historical grounds.
I think we might have a...
I don't agree. Because I would wager that the Equal Protection Clause would not have been ratified in the form in which it stated, if it had been explained to the people that this would invalidate laws against interracial marriage. Professor, as he then was, Professor McConnell, has done interesting historical work on the Reconstruction Amendments, and he did it in an effort to provide a historical pedigree for Brown versus Board of Education, which I think is only slightly less difficult than finding a historical pedigree for Loving versus Virginia. He was forced in his historical research to rely very heavily on post-legislative history, that is, on what congressmen said after 1868, and he mentioned in the 1875 discussion. So I don't really think there's a good historical pedigree for Brown or an a fortiori for Loving. They're perfectly good decisions, but they're not good decisions because they honor the original intent of the 14th Amendment. Now, if one he did mention principles. If one thinks of constitutional provisions as establishing general principles, then of course it becomes easy to give a historical pedigree to any modern decision by just saying, well, the principle of right to counsel, the principle of equal protection, the principle of due process was deliberately made open-ended to be filled in centuries later by judges. You can say that, but of course what you're really saying is you're treating the Constitution as a delegation of legislative power to judges. Since that's the reality, why don't we recognize it? And then if we appoint judges who are timid about legislation, we'll have restraint. And if we appoint judges who are aggressive about policy, wanting to make their policy preferences law, well, we'll be alert. We'll say those people, suppose you have some person who has a real reputation of political activism. He's a very political person. He's been a legislator and so on. And at this confirmation hearing, he says, well, you know, I've been a legislator, but now I'm going to be a judge. And I'm just going to apply, I'm going to follow history and precedent and this and that and the other. So you don't have to worry about me just because I was a legislator. Well, I think you should say to the person, if you're going to be an appellate judge, you are predestined to be exercising legislative authority in that minority of cases which are in this open area, and therefore, since you are temperamentally legislative in character, we don't want you as a judge.
Judge McConnell, you wrote that overwhelming public acceptance of certain Supreme Court decisions, quote, whatever their original legal merit, constitutes a mode of popular ratification which gives these decisions legitimacy and authority. Judge Posner says that this view, quote, licenses political judging, for it says to the judge, if you think you understand the direction in which public opinion is moving, get out in front of the parade, decide the case without reference to originalist dogma, and if your political instincts are correct, your decision will be accepted, including by originalists. Can you say a bit more about why overwhelming public acceptance should matter to an originalist, or is Judge Posner right about this?
Well, I think it's sort of compared to what? If our principle is that judges simply do what they think is going to be lead to the best consequence, we're never going to be able to say that any decisions are wrong, right? Because essentially we're depriving us of any basis for critique of the legality of the decision. Now, Judge Posner does say only in the open cases, right? But I think that's significant because that does suggest that maybe in the non-open cases that text and legalism and so forth ought to control. And what worries me is the idea that because there are some open cases, we then leech the rest of the law of its legalism. You know, precedent is the question is good. I just say the point that I make about precedent is I actually think that there are three things to be said. Precedent is greatly under theorized in our system, so this is not the basis of huge thought on my part or that I can draw on much from others. But it seems inevitable, and if Hamilton is right, indispensable that we have a doctrine of precedent, right? And the question and the first point I would make is that what is really essential is that we have some kind of a consistent doctrine of precedent, because what is not acceptable is to have justices, when they are confronted with, say, a decision that they don't like, call it Bowers versus Hardwick, feel perfectly free to ignore the precedent, but when they're confronted with a precedent that they do like, say, Roe versus Wade, say, well, the precedent is binding and we're now going to go with it. What I say is that the only principle that I can think of that both might have some coherence and also some democratic justification is to say that precedent becomes binding in cases in which it has been fully embraced by the people. And I realize that this is a bit of a fuzzy concept, but basically where it's now accepted, where legislatures adopt it, where it becomes exceedingly unlikely that legislatures are going to be passing laws the other way, and which the people accept it. It doesn't become, doesn't make the original decision right. I would still say, you know, the original decision was probably wrong. But what I, what it does do is it says that the judge today needn't relitigate that case. That it is, that there, that you don't have to go back and get and correct all the mistakes of our predecessors, right? We can, we can begin from now and move forward and accept as and accept some mistakes of the past because they now have democratic warrant, and that that is a legitimate thing for a judge to do.
Thank you. I had intended to
take Judge Posner.
But just gonna, what? How do you evaluate Plessy versus Ferguson on that, on that basis?
Well, since I think Plessy versus Ferguson was wrong on the day it was decided, and by the time of 1954, the Supreme Court had wised up to that, I think it was entirely correct. Now, was it illegitimate for the court, say, in those years? I don't know what years they were, you know, 45, you know, there was presumably a period when they still adhered to Plessy versus Ferguson, even after they may have lost faith in it because it was a precedent. I don't blame them for doing that, right? I'm not saying that precedents can never be overturned. I'm saying that it is permissible for judges to rely on precedents even if the original jurisprudential foundations of the cases were shaky or incorrect. I'm not saying that they are ever read into stone. I think it would be very strange to say that that precedents can never be ever overruled.
Judges, I'm afraid we're out of time. We were supposed to take questions from the audience, but I hope you all forgive me. This was obviously not a discussion to be interrupted. So thank you very much.